Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. As you know from the agenda, we have a number of bills that are scheduled for today for public hearing, and as you can see, the room is full. We're going to try to do this without using a timer, but I do understand that many individuals realize that we're going to try to stay close to 3 minutes with the exception of our first panel. But knowing those are our elected officials, they will be wanting to have as many of you that are not elected officials testifying. So I think they will hopefully self-monitor. We're going to go in an order of starting with Senate Bill 525. Then it looks like we're going to 526 and then 563 and then end it with Senate Bill 3. So with that, we're opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 525. Jeff?
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 525 prohibits possession of a firearm or ammunition if a person is the subject of a restraining order continued after an opportunity for a hearing or if the person has been convicted of a qualifying misdemeanor involving domestic violence. The bill states that the prohibition does not apply if the offense is expunged. Senate Bill 525 allows for relief from the prohibition upon a court petition. We have three amendments before us today. The proposed -1 amendments have the effect of disallowing dispossession at the ex parte stage of the hearings. Proposed -2 amendments fix technical issues with the bills. With the bill, and the proposed -3 amendments delete the catch-all language concerning the prohibition from firearms upon conviction for any misdemeanor that involves, as an element of the crime, the use of physical force or a deadly weapon.
All right, thank you. The other thing I forgot to tell everyone, there is not going to be any work sessions today on any of the bills. We're going to be using our time as efficiently as we can to get the testimony in, so please don't think we're going to be moving bills today. So that means if you're wanting to put additional testimony on in the sense of written material you want to send to us or whatever, you can get that to Legislative Council. That will become part of the record. The last thing I ask, if you have handed in written testimony, please do not read it verbatim. I will ask you to summarize that so we can just get the high points. Everything that you've submitted will be part of the official record, and all of us here at the dais will take that in consideration. So with that, our first set of speakers I have is our Attorney General, Senator Manus Anderson, Representative Langener, and is the other Representative Pelosi, is she? Okay. Peluso's not here, so Attorney General Rosenbaum, would you like to start off, or does Senator Manus Anderson?
I'll defer to Senator Manus Anderson to begin.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Manus Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and parts of East Portland. In 2014, 42 Oregonians died as a result of domestic violence offenders. Approximately 60% of those deaths were by firearms. Federal law prohibits the possession of firearms by domestic violence offenders, but because this law is not codified in Oregon, our system cannot enforce the law and victims don't have protection. Senate Bill 25 will codify the federal law in Oregon to ensure protection for victims. This bill is just one very small step of our domestic violence for our domestic violence victims, and we want to make sure that they're safe. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for Oregon, and I come to you today in support of Senate Bill 525. As Attorney General, I administer all the parts of the Department of Justice, but I have a particular soft spot for the Crime Victim Services Division, which acts as the primary agency administering the grants and services upon which crime victims rely in their time of greatest need. This division also tracks many of the national issues which most significantly impact the victims of crime. And it is in this capacity that I come before you today to talk about the clear and unacceptable connection between gun violence and domestic abuse. In an average year, around 20% of all homicides are related to domestic violence. Approximately two-thirds of those homicides involve the use of a firearm. Nationwide, the risk of homicide is 20 times higher in homes where there's both an established history of domestic violence and ready access to guns. Domestic violence assaults with guns are 12 times more likely to be fatal than assaults without guns. But this tells only part of the story. Research shows that domestic abusers who possess guns tend to use them as part of their pattern of abuse, as a ready threat of further violence, and as a tool for psychological control and mistreatment. The domestic violence fatality statistics are shocking, but cannot be allowed to overshadow the struggles of those who live under the constant threat of firearm-related violence against themselves and their children. Federal law recognizes this danger by prohibiting individuals convicted of certain crimes of domestic violence from possessing guns and ammunition. However, these federal protections are not fully codified in Oregon law. This means that Oregon courts have no specific statutory mechanism by which to order domestic violence offenders to surrender their weapons. As a result, many abusers never turn them over at all. In the absence of actions from the courts, the entire state is left to rely on the 14 Oregon-based federal agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And while these agents do good work, it's not reasonable to expect this small team of federal agents to shoulder this significant burden for the entire state of Oregon. Senate Bill 525 provides Oregon judges with the tools they need to protect victims of domestic abuse and will in turn provide state and local law enforcement with the power to seize firearms from convicted domestic abusers. I believe that this bill represents a tremendous opportunity to save lives, and I urge your support for Senate Bill 525. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, and I'm delighted to be here today in support of Senate Bill 525. I'm a state representative for Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland, but before I started that work, I was a Clackamas County Commissioner, and I've also been a member of Clackamas Women's Services Board of Directors. That's the Clackamas Domestic Violence Services Organization. And in those roles, we worked really hard to create the Family Justice Center, which is a one-stop service center where survivors of domestic violence can get the help they need to get temporary restraining orders, counseling, housing, shelter services. It's a really great resource, but there's a missing piece. And the missing piece is the fact that if a survivor of domestic violence lives in a household where there is a gun, the chance of dying from homicide from an intimate partner is really high. It's troublingly high, as the Attorney General has just stated. And this bill offers us a chance to help address that situation. According to the FBI, there were 138 domestic violence murders in Oregon between 2003 and 2012. And more than half of those victims were killed with guns. In November 2014 alone, seven women were killed in Oregon in domestic violence murders, and five of those killings involved guns. We know that there are steps that we can take. There are steps that we have taken, and it's hard. But just as we laud the bravery of women and men and kids who step forward and say, it's not okay for me to be a victim, we need to harness our own bravery and step forward and say it's time for us to restrict access to firearms for people who are convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors and subject to temporary restraining orders for domestic violence. As a former Clackamas County Commissioner, as a board member of Clackamas Women's Services, and as a mother who wants to keep my kids safe and other people's kids safe, I encourage you to support Senate Bill 525. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
To the Attorney General, thank you for your support of this bill. I think it could save lives. This is basically an enforcement measure, isn't that correct?
Correct, absolutely.
This doesn't really create a new body of law, is that correct?
Senator Burdick, that is correct, members of the committee and Chair Przanski. This would add to an already existing law a category of individuals that, frankly, is missing from that law, but it doesn't add any additional anything other than that. It adds this category of convicted offenders and those who are subject to restraining orders to an already existing law to enforce against those individuals.
Thank you.
Senator Thatcher.
I kept hearing, excuse me, I have a frog in my throat. I kept hearing emphasis on those convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors and crimes, and I don't think you'd hear much argument there. But then I also hear the addition of those subject to a restraining order where there hasn't been a conviction. And do you see any issue with that? I mean, where there's just been an accusation, there hasn't been a conviction.
Senator Przanski, Senator Thatcher, thank you for that question. I believe that the proposed law goes further than simply someone who's been accused, but rather requires there to have been a continuation of the restraining order, requires there to have been a hearing so that that individual has had the opportunity to be heard. That is true. The law would be broader as written than convicted misdemeanants, but it's a very important group of individuals against whom there are active outstanding restraining orders and who've already had a hearing on those in order to have a court determine whether they should be continued or not.
Okay, so there's a hearing, but there has been no determination of guilt still, right?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, not guilt per se, because it's not a conviction, but yes, in terms of the right to due process for an individual who's had a restraining order petition filed against them, they've had the right to go to court, they've had the opportunity to be heard, and for a court to determine whether the restraining order should be continued. And the determination has been yes. So based upon the criteria that a court considers, there is an outstanding restraining order against an individual, and he or she has had the right to be heard on that. So it is true, you are correct, Senator Thatcher, that it is not a conviction for a crime. The person possibly could have already been convicted of a crime, but not necessarily. However, we have a lot of due process rights for individuals in connection with the obtaining of restraining orders. And they have to be on the basis of facts that have been established before a court.
Hello?
Not this time. Thanks.
Okay. Excuse me, Senator. I was getting ready to release the panel, but go right ahead.
Just quickly, it would be interesting to have the information about fatalities that come when there is an active restraining order in place and the danger that a victim is in when there is an active restraining order in place.
Chair Przanski, Senator Gelser, I'd be happy to provide those to you. In fact, I would venture, and this is probably a little bit dangerous for me to be venturing anything in front of this august body here this morning, but to say that though where there are active restraining orders, those individuals might actually be more dangerous than someone who's been convicted of a misdemeanor and has been on probation and has been receiving services.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for
coming. And it's the dash twos that I would support.
All right, thank you. All right, so our next panel is going to be Sybil Head and Aaron Greenwald.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 525. Very much appreciate the committee's attention to this vitally important matter and very much appreciate the support of our sponsoring legislators. As you know, the Law Center is its mission is to provide access to justice to low-income, vulnerable Oregonians. And a significant percentage of our clients come to us looking for help and assistance in escaping domestic violence. It's one of our highest priorities, and that dynamic is one of the biggest risks, frankly, to our clients, to their lives and to their capacity to escape poverty and to escape a cycle of violence. So we are very committed as a firm to helping to be a part of the coordinated community response and to making sure that our communities and our law enforcement partners have the tools that they need in order to help protect victims and provide accountability for batterers. You've heard the statistics about the lethality of the combination of domestic violence and firearms, and I can't add more in terms of statistics than what you've already heard. What I would like to do is share with you a snapshot of deaths that took place in Oregon in the month of November in 2013, because I think they illustrate in the particulars of their cases the statistics that we've been discussing. So on November 1st in Jackson County in November of 2013, Kimberly Ann Stack was fatally shot in the head by her boyfriend, Robert Joseph Simonson, while they were staying at a friend's apartment. On November 2nd, the next day, in Lane County, Casey Lynn Wright was bludgeoned to death by her boyfriend, Robert Cromwell, at his home. On November 3rd, again the next day, in Clackamas County, after an altercation with his girlfriend, from which she escaped, Lawrence Cambra set their home on fire and fatally shot responding police officer Robert Libke before killing himself. On November 20th, in Coos County, Ladd Robinson beat his half-brother Lance Lucero to death at the home of his parents. On November 22nd, in Marion County, Adrienne Bird was shot to death by her estranged boyfriend, Dustin Michael Bryant, in front of her daughter and police. And those deaths in that one single month in 2013 illustrate the incidences, the severity. 60% of those deaths were by firearm, and they illustrate that the impact is felt not only by the primary victims, but also by family members. Also by perpetrators also die in these cases. Police officer lost his life, and at least one of these deaths was witnessed by a minor child who will be impacted forever by the trauma of that and by having lost her mother and growing up without her mother. And so that's an illustration of why we're here today, what we'd like to do. In recognition of the lethal connection between domestic violence and firearms, it has long been the case that federal law has outlawed possession by domestic violence offenders who've been adjudicated by the court either through a restraining order process or through a misdemeanor conviction process. That's been true since the mid-1990s. Unfortunately, the reason that we're here today is that federal law really doesn't provide an option or a tool in Oregon, and Oregonians continue to die. The gaps in coverage in Oregon are twofold. One is that the federal law only applies to people who have been determined to be, quote-unquote, intimate partners within the federal definition of that relationship, and that is a narrow definition. It excludes some of the principal categories of people who are suffering from this crime. One is it excludes family members who are related by blood or marriage, so it would exclude violence and fatalities between siblings. It would exclude violence between parents and children and other relatives. It also excludes dating partners unless they have ever lived together. And as we know, the statistics show that a significant category of domestic violence injuries and fatalities occur between people who are dating partners. So leaving out protection for that category of relationship is a significant gap. In addition to the gap, substantively, it's almost impossible to enforce federal law in Oregon for the reasons that have been outlined. And that's because there are not enough federal law enforcement officers and because our state law enforcement officers, who are the ones who are in communities responding to domestic violence incidences, calling and responding to 911 calls, working with victims, working with perpetrators, those are the enforcement officers who need this tool in our communities, and we need to give it to them. We think it's high time for Oregon to act to make sure that law enforcement has the tools that they need, and this bill would provide that by implementing in our current protected prohibited possessor statutes these two additional categories of domestic violence offenders. And those would be people who are subject to an Oregon restraining order. That would be a little bit broader than the federal definition because Oregon restraining orders are available between family or household members, which would include siblings and include parent and children relationships, and it would also include dating partners. That's been true in Oregon law since the 1970s. That is the category of relationships that is defined as worthy of protection in the domestic violence, family violence world. So those two categories would be added to Oregon's prohibited possessor statutes. Those are statutes that our law enforcement officers enforce on a daily basis, and this would give them the tool that they need so that when they're responding to the calls of crisis in their communities, they can help. I would point out that we would support the Dash 2 amendment, which contains just a technical fix. There were two typos of cross-references in the printed bill, and those amendments would correct those. We oppose the Dash 1 and the Dash 3 amendments. I would also outline that many other states, just to give you a broader picture, have passed laws that are broader than the federal law and that implement the federal law at the local level, and it's for the reasons that we have described, because the federal law has gaps and because it cannot be enforced by state law enforcement officers. And so just as a larger perspective, there are 19 states currently, as well as D.C., that prohibit possession by offenders who are convicted of misdemeanor crimes. Also 23 states, as well as D.C., policy that prohibit possession by offenders who are subject to restraining orders. Many states go broader than this proposal, but we propose to simply keep the federal prohibitions of adjudicated restraining orders and adjudicated offenders through the criminal process and add them to our statutes. I would note that the most recent legislation on this topic passed in Louisiana, Wisconsin, Washington, and Minnesota, passed with broad bipartisan support, and we hope for the same here in Oregon. We know that federal resources are limited. We know that Oregon law enforcement officers want to help. They do their best every day. They're at great risk from these cases. We hope we can pass this law to give them the tools that they need here in Oregon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Aaron?
Chair, would you like me to defer to Representative Peluso?
I want to let you speak because I'm going to let her speak on two bills.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Greenewald. I'm an attorney at the Oregon Department of Justice. Specifically, I'm the domestic violence resource prosecutor at the Oregon Department of Justice. Prior to coming into that position 5 years ago, I was a domestic violence prosecutor and sex crimes prosecutor in Yamhill County, and before that in Marion County. I've been a prosecutor for a little over 16 years, the entirety of which I've done domestic violence cases. I want to talk to you today and urge your support on Senate Bill 525 with the dash two amendments, but about three specific issues. The first is why law enforcement in the criminal justice system needs Senate Bill 525. I want to talk to you about the dangers that law enforcement faces when dealing with domestic violence perpetrators who have access or who possess firearms. And I'd like to speak with you also, and perhaps most importantly, about how 525 would help victims of domestic violence not only by preventing their deaths, but by significantly reducing the severe abuse that they face every single day when there is a domestic violence perpetrator who has access or who possesses a firearm. In terms of how law enforcement and the criminal justice system need 525, I would say this, and this has been referenced by Ms. Hebb. Right now, law enforcement does not have the ability to use their most effective investigative techniques or even make arrests if they think anyone has violated the federal equivalent of the proposed law of Senate Bill 525. Due to this gap, while there has been training and while law enforcement clearly understands the connection between domestic violence and firearms, even if they think that there has been a violation of those federal laws, they cannot enforce those laws because they do not have jurisdiction. As I believe the Attorney General referenced, there are 14 agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm who could enforce those laws, but that's 14 agents for the entire state. And you might imagine they have a lot of other cases that they need to tend to. And so hours, days, or weeks might go by if a local law enforcement agent calls ATF to investigate one of these violations. And when you have domestic violence and firearms, we don't have hours or days or certainly weeks. The same can be said of prosecutors. They're in the same boat. They receive cases all the time that they feel qualify DV misdemeanors and those who are subject to qualifying restraining order. However, our U.S. Attorney's Office historically has not taken many of those cases. Our current U.S. Attorney in the past few years has taken more cases, her attorneys have taken more cases than we have in the past decade. But when I say more, I mean two or three cases of the many, dozens, perhaps hundreds, that could potentially be prosecuted. Law enforcement and prosecutors, as Ms. Hebb said, are absolutely willing to hold these people accountable and to keep victims safe. But without a law like Senate Bill 525, our hands are tied. The second issue that I'd like to speak with you is about the dangers facing law enforcement. Apart from the obvious and undisputed dangers victims face when there is a firearm, there is a great danger to law enforcement. Nationally, between 1996 and 2009, 106 officers lost their lives responding to domestic violence calls. That was 14% of all officers who died during that period of time. Historically, responding to a domestic violence call for officers, and I believe that Representative Peluso can speak to this personally, is one of the most dangerous calls that an officer can go to. In most law enforcement agencies, and I know we have law enforcement coming up, Typically, the protocol is that an officer cannot respond alone to a domestic violence call because it is so dangerous. And as Ms. Hebb said, we have suffered in this state loss of officers due to their response to domestic violence incidents. Most recently, Officer Robert Lidke responded and was killed in Clackamas County. The perpetrator in that case not only had a violent history, he was subject to a restraining order at the time that he killed Officer Lidke. In just the past few months, and indeed if we were to go back years, we have had multiple incidents, and you can do a simple Google search to even find these cases, of officers being called out, having to deal with armed subjects, and they having to shoot and sometimes kill those armed perpetrators. And while that is sad, it could have just as easily turned out that it would have been the officer or other people, perhaps the public, that would have died. It's not just deaths that we should be worried about, however. Apart from the increase in the potential lethality so clearly demonstrated when you introduce domestic violence, guns into a domestic violence relationship, a perpetrator's access to or possession of guns also corresponds to the severity of abuse experienced and suffered by DV victims, and I know the advocates who are going to speak directly to this. And this makes sense because, as we know, in domestic violence cases, violence tends to escalate. Once a gun has been recognized by the perpetrator as an effective tool in maintaining control over the victim, that perpetrator is going to go back to using that tool again and again. In one study in the American Journal of Public Health, 417 women in 67 shelters in California were interviewed. A third of them had lived in households with a firearm. In two-thirds of those houses, their partners had used a gun against them or their children. It was usually the threat of killing them. Deaths, of course, are the most perceptible and tangible result of firearm use, and we need to prevent as many deaths as possible. But I'd like for the committee to understand, and I'm sure that you do, that women around Oregon every single day are terrorized by domestic violence perpetrators, many of whom are terrorizing them with firearms. Just yesterday, part of my job is I do technical assistance to prosecutors around the state. Just yesterday, I received an email from a prosecutor who had sort of a legal sticky wicket because he had received a case in intake. The defendant had significantly beat his girlfriend. Throughout the course of the night, he'd also taken out a firearm and was threatening to kill himself, saying, "If you leave," to the victim, "if you leave, I will kill myself." Now, justifiably, she was concerned about her own safety because he had previously assaulted her that night and perhaps in the past. But it doesn't fit nicely into any of the crimes that we have. Do we shoehorn that into a coercion charge? Do we shoehorn that into unlawful use of a weapon charge? We know, those of us who work in domestic violence, that, of course, that is a tactic that perpetrators use to control the victim, and that's exactly what this defendant was doing, the coercion of her, the terrorizing of her in that particular instance. Last month, I helped write a motion for a deputy DA in Marion County. The defendant, over a course of 3 years, had terrorized not only the victim, but her children. And now she had a child, a young baby, with him. In the incident that we were talking about, and this prosecutor was trying to hold him in custody, he had beaten her and had also threatened her and the children with a firearm to the point where, luckily, she was able to escape and go to the next door neighbor and call for help. Ultimately, when they were able to do a search warrant, I think they seized 18 firearms from that house. Who knows what kind of terror, other than the incidents that the victim ultimately disclosed, had happened to those children and to that woman.
I need you to wrap up, please.
I'm sorry, yes. I would just say, again, that it's not just about the deaths that we want to prevent. It's about the terror and the abuse that also is important. And this Senate Bill 525 would be a tool to help us reduce that terror. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peluso, pleasure meeting you. I understand from looking at our witness list that you wanted to give testimony not only on 525 that we have open now, but you may also want to make comment on 526. Is that correct? All right, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 526 for the purpose of allowing the representative to give her testimony on both bills now.
Would you like a description?
No. Okay.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I am the representative from House District 50, which includes Gresham and a small portion of Southeast Portland. I am here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 525, which will go a long way in protecting women and children who are or will experience violence in the home. Many of you know I worked in law enforcement for 30 years with the Gresham Police Department and was honored to serve as police chief for my last 6 years. During my time in law enforcement, I worked on cases involving murder, rape, child abuse, and domestic violence. The domestic violence cases had a profound impact on me, and I knew I wanted to do more to protect the women and children that find themselves facing domestic violence. In the early 90s, I secured a $750,000 federal grant and formed a special unit in Gresham dedicated solely to investigating domestic violence crimes. I wanted to make sure that not only were there trained detectives in the unit to put criminals behind bars, but advocates who could help victims recover from their abuse and bring their attackers to justice. As a police officer, I responded to way too many domestic violence-related calls. As a detective, I investigated way too many domestic violence-related calls. As a hostage negotiator, I responded to domestic violence-related special emergency response team call-outs, where the typical scenario involved an abuser who had barricaded himself, the victim, and most often children in the home. As a police lieutenant, I initiated and supervised the domestic violence reduction unit, and as police chief, I kept that unit staffed and funded for almost 6 years, but none of that prepared me for one crime scene that never goes away. Out of respect for the survivors in this room, I will be brief. I was a lieutenant working the graveyard shift, a call of shots fired, second story apartment, no additional information. The first two patrol cars arrived, gave out the exact location of the apartment. I mentioned that it was the second story, as most often there are two flights of stairs which double back, which allow no concealment and can make the approach and entry into the apartment very dangerous, and as responding officers, you feel very vulnerable. The first two arriving officers, as they approached the front door, heard the sounds of screaming children, found the door unlocked, opened the door, at the same time a shotgun blast echoed everywhere. The screaming intensified. Officers called for code 3 cover, two more officers arrived, and there was no radio transmission for what seemed like an eternity. I believe I was the next to arrive, but to be honest, I'm not certain. Between adrenaline, stress, and fear, things get a little blurry. But what I do remember is walking into the most horrific crime scene I have ever seen. The first shotgun blast at close range took the life of the victim, a mother of two children. Those children were in the bed with the mother when she was shot. The second shotgun blast at close range was the cowardly act of the abuser taking his own life. I think this is enough information to make my point. Was a restraining order out on the abuser? Yes. Did the abuser, with a felony record of violence, have access to a shotgun? Apparently so. In this case and so many others, that makes me a supporter of this bill. Just because a restraining order is in place does not mean victims are guaranteed protection from their abuser. If a weapon is within reach of an abuser, the risk of homicidal violence is extreme. That is why Senate Bill 525 is needed. Senate Bill 525 will save lives. I urge you all to support this bill.
And 526.
Yes, sir. Again, I am Carla Peluso. I'm still Carla Peluso, still that same senator, person representing House District 50. And I am back to voice my support for Senate Bill 526, a bill I joined Senator Manas Anderson and Senator Winters to chief sponsor. You have heard at length about my background as a police officer, including police chief. This experience, colleagues, brings officers face to face with a lot of hard facts. One of those facts is that far too many individuals, primarily women and their children, are put in danger, are seriously injured, and far too often murdered at the hands of their intimate partner. Senate Bill 526 takes important steps within the criminal justice system to further protection for victims of domestic violence. Increasing the penalties to the level of a felony for the crime of strangulation should happen across the board, and it makes sense that we begin with pregnant women. Pregnant women are especially vulnerable to domestic violence and at a higher risk for lethality when they experience abuse. And an interesting thought crossed my mind when I was preparing to speak to you all this morning regarding strangulation and domestic violence. Interfering with a 911 call is commonly used by abusers to attempt to restrict a police response to a domestic violence call. Overpowering the victim and taking away the cell phone, damaging the cell phone, hiding the cell phone are all common tactics. Think about this triggered the domestic violence calls I responded to in the days when we had telephones that were actually attached to a phone cord that was attached to a wall. We called them landlines back then. I have clear recollection of three calls, and I believe there were more, of responding to domestic violence calls where upon arrival was able to interrupt and stop an abuser who had literally pulled the cord from the wall in an attempt to stop the victim from calling the police and was now using that cord to strangle the victim. Relevant today, maybe not. Important to remember, always, tools, gadgets, utensils are always readily available inside a home that can cause serious injury and death. Additionally, when abuse occurs in a home where children are present, we all know that children are negatively affected by that violence. Too many children are caught in a home environment marked by the threat of harm, feelings of tension and of fear, and truly unfortunate idea that violence is okay to solve problems and to get power. Children are victims of abuse, regardless of whether or not they are physically touched. Under current law, when children witness violence, the crime is automatically considered a felony. This bill would additionally name that child as a victim in a case which allows greater protections for that child under the laws and speaks to the totality of harm the perpetrator of violence has caused. Another important part of this bill is the increased teeth it gives to protective orders. Too many perpetrators do not fear violating a protective order. They know it often is a contempt of court violation, maybe an overnight in jail, and limited punishment when they are in front of a judge. Classifying it as a Class A misdemeanor takes steps towards acknowledging the seriousness of these violations and the risk the perpetrator is to the victim and her or his children. This is good common sense legislation that helps the law to back up what we know about the dangers of abusers and work towards providing better protections for victims. Thank you, Chair Przanski, and members of the committee for allowing me once again to speak on behalf of this important legislation. I appreciate your time and welcome any questions.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Thatcher.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, you paint a picture of really horrible, horrible things. And I'm wondering, Representative Peluso, you were mentioning some of the tools, you know, people will use if they're bent to be harmful to people, they will use whatever's handy.
Correct.
And I think earlier testimony, they talked, I think Sybil, it was you, was kind of delineating some of the things that happened in November. And there's bludgeoning and fires and beatings and, you know, horrible, awful deaths that occurred. And then you mentioned some states that adopted these laws or similar laws to what we're looking at now. And I don't know if they're so recent that it's hard to determine if lives have actually been saved or if they, if some of these states have actually had these laws in place for a while that they can show that, look, here's what it was before, here's what it is now after these laws have been passed and lives have actually been saved due to firearms, whatever. I'm just wondering if that is...
I can speak to that.
Is the case. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, members of the committee, I can speak to that that question. And so I believe it's 19 states have the restriction against possession if you've been convicted of a misdemeanor, and 23 states have restrict possession if you've been subject to a restraining order or while you're subject to a restraining order. So there's a broad spectrum. That also includes, in addition, Washington, D.C. So there are only five states that have recently passed this. Most of the other states have had those protections in for some greater time. I don't know exactly how long they've all been in place, but years. Since VAWA passed, since the Violence Against Women Act passed in the mid-1990s, states since then, I think, have been struggling and realizing that it is very difficult to enforce actively because state law enforcement aren't don't have jurisdiction over federal crimes. And so states have been adopting these gradually over years. We do have statistics to get to your specific question. There's a study conducted in the state of Maryland over a period of 10 years, I believe, might have been longer. I'll look for that statistic and get it to you, but a significant chunk of time, which indicated a 19% reduction in fatalities, domestic violence fatalities, after the passage of laws similar to this. Restricting firearm possession. So we do think that it helps, and we have the statistics that show that it helps, and we also know anecdotally, talking to our law enforcement partners, that it's a tool they don't have right now. So we'd like to give it to them.
Follow up.
And just to follow up on, I just want to, if you remember, and I understand you probably don't have all this memorized, I understand, but when you say a 19% reduction in fatalities, in domestic violence fatalities, are you talking about fatalities generally or just firearms fatalities, and yet there are still fatalities?
So
something else?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Thatcher, and members of the committee, I'll get you the specific statistic in the study. The information I have says that state laws that restrict access to firearms by a person who is a domestic violence offender or subject to a restraining order, rather, is associated with a significant reduction in the number of intimate partner homicides. And one study has found, the Maryland study, that such laws are associated with a 19% risk in the risk of intimate partner homicide. 19% reduction in the risk, of intimate partner homicide. So I think it does not answer your specific question. I'll get you that information.
Does it say what document is that?
Why don't we do this? I'll take this one offline because it seems to me that we need to provide that study to the senator.
Happy to do that.
And I'd ask that you provide it to council. That way everyone on the dais will have it.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Not for now.
All right. Thank
you
all very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to be Rod Underhill. I believe it's Amy Matusko and Lauren Robinson. And Rod, are you going to lead off for us, or did y'all have an order?
Chair, up to you. We had not decided. I'd actually prefer to have those two go first, if they would
As a true, no one's not a prosecutor there, but understanding one of the last words. So whoever would like to start?
Suppose that's me. Good morning, Chair Prasansky and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Robertson. I'm a deputy district attorney from Lincoln County, Oregon. A good portion of my job is actually spent prosecuting cases of domestic violence, and I'm here to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 525 and why we're in support of it. As Attorney General Rosenblum presented to you, we have a lot of statistics that are out there that show the combination of domestic violence and guns is a lethal combination. We know this. The numbers speak to this. I think in large part this is why we've had the federal prohibitions in place since the mid-90s. But when we're talking about Senate Bill 525, I think it's very important that we have those numbers at the forefront of our minds. So in Oregon, when we talk about domestic violence in combination with violent deaths, domestic violence is the cause of 1 in 4 of those. And as Attorney General Rosenblum ended up telling you earlier, is that 60% of the fatalities that we have that are domestic violence related have been the result of the use of a firearm. And when we talk about domestic violence offenders having access to weapons, what we're talking about is we're talking about homes where there's a 20-time higher likelihood of a result of a homicide in that home. And when we talk about domestic violence assaults and the combination of firearms, we're talking about assaults where there's a 12-time higher likelihood of a fatality. So again, domestic violence and guns, it's a lethal combination. We know that. I have worked with domestic violence victims since 2003, and the gap that Senate Bill 525 identifies and fills is a gap that I've had numerous conversations about with victims I've served. Oftentimes, unfortunately, that conversation has resulted in me saying something to the effect of, we see the risk that's there, and I'm really sorry that the risk is there. Let me go see if there's something we can do to find somebody that can enforce this. Let's refer this to federal prosecution. Now, when we talk about this here, that answer may make a little bit of sense because we've got the federal prohibitions and I'm responsible for state laws. But when I'm speaking with a victim of domestic violence who's been threatened, whose life has been threatened by the use of a gun, from an individual who's been ordered not to have access to guns anymore, that answer doesn't make any sense. The question that I often get back after I say that is, what is it going to take for you to take this seriously? Does there have to be a bullet in my head? Why isn't the law protecting me? And I think this gap is further compounded when we talk about, again, what we're looking at with the federal enforcement. Federal enforcement has been doing a great job, but as you've heard, there are 14 federal enforcement officers that are responsible for enforcing these orders for the 36 counties that we have in Oregon. Those numbers just don't make a situation where we have effective intervention. There is a very real local need that we need to address. And Senate Bill 525 is a straightforward fix to that issue. It's going to give our local law enforcement the ability to intervene and break up this lethal combination of domestic violence and guns. This bill obviously is not going to end all domestic violence fatalities, but this bill has the power to end some of them. This bill has the power to intervene and end some of the worst, most severe cases of domestic violence that we've seen, the terroristic threats that Ms. Grunewald was just speaking about. This bill is also going to send a message that our judges' orders are going to be enforced and that we take these cases seriously. Victim safety and offender accountability is something that's in the forefront of our minds as Oregonians moving forward. Again, we know the combination of domestic violence and guns is lethal. I've worked with officers who've been frustrated knowing that this combination exists, and frankly, I've been frustrated working in the system knowing that this combination exists, and I've been powerless to do anything to intervene. I think one of the reasons that I was asked to speak with you today is because I am from a smaller community. And I think one of the things that you're going to hear is that regardless of the community size, Senate Bill 525 is something that is going to make Oregon a safer place for survivors or victims of domestic violence. One of the things I'm excited about with this as well is that it's going to lead us to a place where I can work with my local law enforcement officers and promptly intervene in situations where we know that intervention is warranted and address those very real safety needs. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning and for the work that you do to make Oregon such a wonderful place to live and work in. Thank you.
Amy?
Good morning. Amy Matusko, Chair Przanski, Senators. I'm here on Benton County District Attorney's behalf today, and I have been working as a district attorney in Oregon for a short time, but I spent a number of years in Washington State as a prosecuting attorney. They're mostly focusing on domestic violence crimes. And I can tell you, coming from a more rural county, firearms are prevalent more. You're having individuals who have those firearms in their home, not as a means of protection solely, but as a day-to-day tool, as a hunting resource, as a means of amusement and fun. And then when you combine domestic violence in a rural county where victims don't have access to resources, they don't have a neighbor that they can run to, maybe it's miles to the next person that can help them. When you combine firearms with domestic violence in a rural county, it's an apparent and imminent need to enforce and restrict domestic violence abusers from having those. When we're looking at domestic violence is like a spider web offense. It's got filaments that reach out into the community, and they touch more than just victims of abuse. They touch children. They touch doctors and nurses who deal with these. They touch law enforcement. And when you hold an offender accountable, whether it's under having a conviction for an assault, a conviction for strangulation, or being subject of a protection order, you're sending a good message to all of those individuals who are part of that spider web. You're sending the message that we will protect victims, we will protect communities, we will protect kids. Those threats of firearms in the home are subtle, often intimidation, as you've already heard. And it's used, say, an individual who's wearing the gun on his hip, and the subject does something they don't like. All they have to do is reach to their hip. That's all that's needed, because they've enforced that message. I've heard from multiple victims over the years about that it takes so many times before they have the strength to come forward, the strength to do anything about it, and that those are issues that are in their home daily, and those threats are to their kids and to their pets and to their families. When you're looking at messages and indirect impacts, think of the kids in that home where that abuser is using that firearm as a tool. What you're teaching children is that firearms are tools to get what they want, to use that. And those kids are taking those messages out even further. Okay? Restraining orders are wonderful, but they're only pieces of paper. And in Washington, I had the particular instance where an 82-year-old woman was subject to violence in her home, where her longtime boyfriend had threatened her and her adult son with a gun. Because of her age, she wasn't comfortable in taking this outside of her home. but she was so concerned that she let her adult son know, and he started a protection order process. And when he went in Washington State and got that protection order, they specifically asked that he not be allowed to possess firearms, which the court was able to do in Washington. And what ended up happening is that restraining order was served on that individual, and the gun was found. And in that instance, the offender lied about the gun. He tried to hide that gun from the officers. And that victim afterwards was notified that the officers had that gun, and the relief was apparent on her face. And she felt comfortable enough to tell the officer what had happened. That's a real life story of being able to protect a victim in a way that they weren't comfortable to come out in the beginning. I thank you for the opportunity to address you today.
Thank you very much. Rod, before you give your testimony on 525, I also noticed that you're on for 526.
I am, sir.
Why don't you go ahead and give us testimony on both of those?
Very well, and I appreciate that. Senator Przanski, or Chair Przanski, thank you very much. Members of the committee, Rod Underhill, I'm the elected district attorney of Multnomah County. I've been a prosecutor for 26 years. Approximately 10 of those years I spent as the senior deputy in charge of the domestic violence unit in Multnomah County. So for the better part of a decade, I did nothing but prosecute crimes of violence against too often women and children in our community's homes. That decade was in the 90s. I was able to see firsthand the tremendous impacts, the before and the after, of the Violence Against Women's Act, the VAWA Act that you've heard referenced a few witnesses ago. The passage of VAWA occurred in the mid-90s, 1994, with the Lautenberg Amendment occurring in 1996. I was there doing that work during that time, and I was able to see firsthand the changes and the resources that were given to local communities and prosecutors. I was able to look with envy at some of the tools that were made available to the federal prosecutors, but not the prosecutors here in the state of Oregon. I became aware at that time, during that era, that we were doing a lot of tremendous work, but there was still a lot of work that needed to be done. I come before you today not just as the elected district attorney of Multnomah County, but also as a father of three children. Two of them are women. They are my daughters. And they are the daughters of my wife. With that in mind, I sometimes wonder about the community and the society for which we are raising our young women. As a father of two daughters, I found myself reflecting on that very question when I attended a Multnomah County Domestic Violence Fatality Review Committee a few years back. On that day, we examined the tragic event where a man murdered his former partner and their four-year-old child. In his final act of cowardice and control, he turned the gun on himself and he pulled the trigger. The group that I was with was tasked with searching to determine what happened and what we, as a community, could do in order to avoid such a tragic event from ever occurring again. Now, as we did that work, one of the members of our group, a woman, in a tone of frustration, anger, despair, and pain, she spoke up about her feelings and her thoughts, and they impacted me. And what she said was, "Men need to be talking to men." She raised her voice and she continued. And she said, "Men in leadership roles need to be telling other men to stop the violence." Now, her words were honest, they were heartfelt, and they were correct. Men, all men, but especially men in leadership, need to be even more determined than we have ever been in our lives, even louder and more persistent than ever. Women have been strong, they have been vocal, and they have been persistent leaders, and we've heard from several of them so far today, in this area for now decades. We need to collectively redouble our efforts to stop the violence in the home. We need to redouble our efforts as a community, as a society, to stop this violence. So as a father of two daughters, I need to speak up and say that men too often look at young girls and women as something to dominate, possess, and own, and that that must stop. That oppressive and too often fatal mentality is occurring daily in the homes, and the hotels and the streets in our communities. We know that domestic violence abusers who own or have access to a firearm, when violence occurs in that home, it is 5 times more likely to result in death. And I dare say I have responded to far too many death-involved family violence situations in my career. I don't want to do that anymore. We need to take the firearms out of the hands of the abusers. The VAWA Act in the mid-90s provided the federal government with the ability to charge as a crime certain acts involving gun dispossession in situations that our state statutes do not allow. We need to look hard, as we are doing here today, at Oregon state statutes and make the changes that will allow state prosecutors and law enforcement officers to criminally charge domestic violence abusers who continue to unlawfully possess firearms. When a court has ordered an abuser dispossessed of their right to own or have access to a firearm, we need to provide law enforcement with the resources and the protocols and the laws to take those firearms from the abuser. That is why I am supporting Senate Bill 525. It closes the gap in enforcement relative to the federal law. Passage of 525 will protect victims from firearm violence. It will do it. Whose life will it save? I don't know. I can't tell you. But it will save lives. Senate Bill 525 will codify federal law by making Oregon's current firearm prohibition statutes reflect the two federal law categories of domestic violence offenders: those subject to a restraining order that have been upheld after their due process right to a hearing, and those convicted of a qualifying misdemeanor domestic violence crime. As the father of two daughters, I want to, with all of you, have theirs and their future free from violence in this community. We can do this by working together, each of us, in our communities, by changes of our laws. We can assist our mothers, our sisters, daughters, and our sons. We can change their future one at a time, and collectively we'll move society. As a father of two daughters, and as the district attorney for Multnomah County, and as a prosecutor who has done this work for a decade of my career, I am very grateful for this opportunity, for the leadership I am looking at and seeing, the leadership of Senator Mona Sanderson, for her courageous desire to put forward this effort, and I'm very thankful for those efforts. Regarding 526, I support 526 relative to sections 1 through 4. I best summarize it because I know you're short on time. You've got a lot of people you want to hear from, sir. And I know you're going to hear a lot more about 526.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. I'm going to let you all step back, and we're going to go ahead and go to the next panel. Next panel is going to be Pat Moore and Don Johnson. And at this point, gentlemen, and for others, we're going to have to use the 3-minute timer at this point, at least for the proponents. I think we've covered a lot. I know we're going to get some more additional information, but I do need to ensure that the opponents and others that are here for other bills have the opportunity to be heard.
Chair Pruszynski and members of the committee, Don Johnson from the city of Lake Oswego, and I come to you in support of 525. From a practical standpoint, I've got 35 years behind me in law enforcement, chief of police for more than 15 years in 3 different cities. And over that time, I've seen the statistics that have been borne out today. One of the things that I committed to a long time ago in life was to provide victims with the best protection. And I've been involved with domestic violence issues since about 1985. And some of the things that we've done in the county that we're in right now, Clackamas County, is to get agreement from all the police chiefs that from the time the call comes in until the time the case resolves, that we'll all respond and we'll all apply the resources the exact same way. We've got a signed domestic violence protocol agreement. One of the other steps that we need to take to protect the victims is to be able to dispossess them lawfully of firearms. I can tell you practically, I would have no idea how to employ the federal statute, period. And likewise, I don't think any of my colleagues in the county or across the state would. This bill really does provide the victims an extra measure of protection. Coming out of a different county that had 1.8 million people in the county, we would run as many domestic violence programs, as many resources toward domestic violence as we could, including laws like this, including protocols, including significant prosecution rates. And we dropped the domestic violence rate in that county, 1.8 million people versus 3 million people in the state of Oregon, 1.8 million. We'd run about anywhere from 5 to 11 domestic violence deaths a year. And of those, the statistics still bore out. They were 60% firearms. So I would urge you to support 525. Thank you.
Thank you. And Pat?
Yes, sir. Chair Przanski, committee members, once again, thank you. It's a privilege to be here. I'm Patrick Moore. I'm a lieutenant with the Roseburg Police Department and commander of the Douglas Interagency Narcotics Team. As most of my experiences have been echoed by my colleagues already, I'll choose to just illuminate two and a half salient points. Number one, as has been echoed, there simply is no reason not to be consistent with the federal statutes on this issue. Local law enforcement, by that I mean state, county, and municipal departments, are the primary point persons on domestic violence and violation of restraining orders. That is overwhelmingly true. Number two, the language in this bill, as within 526, which I also think is a very solidly worded bill, illuminates the fact that these are the worst offenders that with whom we deal, with whom we arrest. Even though they have not yet been convicted of a felony, they show the highest potential and propensity for future violence, and that is also illuminated by their potential for crossover offending. Statistics are fairly unanimous that domestic abusers are also the most likely to, in the future, or having already committed unreported or under-investigated acts of child abuse and sexual assault. And point three, as SWAT commander for 14 of my 21 years, I can verify that overwhelmingly the majority of our hostage-based standoffs have involved domestic violence as the predicating factor behind the standoff or the hostage-taking occurring to begin with in the first place. And by overwhelming majority, off the top of my head, I would say well over 90%. I can't think of one that was not domestic-based in the relationship between the parties. Those all support what we all know to be true, is that domestic disturbances is where emotions run highest, and you know, the most dangerous emotion there, of course, is violence. And with that, I'd be happy to field any questions.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for this panel?
Well, I don't know if this is the appropriate panel or if the last one was, but I didn't get an opportunity. But at some point, I would like to hear how, maybe somebody could take me through how this would actually work.
I'm happy
to field
that question,
ma'am. How it would actually be carried out, like somebody would come to somebody's home and search it, or how it would work? I guess I would just
I think
how it would be carried out.
I'm not sure if the officers are the appropriate ones. I don't think the district attorney offices are either. I think it would be more to have Ms. Hebb come back up, or we could do that offline. But so, yeah.
Thank you. I guess I would just kind of
Curious. I think the procedural, we should leave that for the advocate of the legislation.
Sure.
Chair Przanski, with your permission, might I offer, I'll send to you, Senator, and you, Senator Thatcher, Multnomah County's protocol about how to, the procedures and protocols of operationally what the court does relative to getting the guns out of abusers' hands when there is the restraining order matter at hand.
Does that suffice?
I would appreciate that.
All right. So just for the record, District Attorney Rod Underhill is going to provide to the committee the protocol that Multnomah County is using for the process of how this procedure would work. Thank you very much.
It would need to be, just so this said, there would need to be slight modifications to it with this law change, because relative to the procedure employed right now, it's obviously different. But it'll give you a framework.
Okay. That's great. Thank you, Rod. All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, our next panel are going to be, and I'm just trying to read off here, it looks like Dr. Aney, and I cannot tell if that's Don or John, Santa, Chloe Marcellello, and Tyn Downey. Hopefully I got those correct. Jane? Yeah, maybe it's Jane? Okay. I apologize if I butchered names here. I'm trying to read the print that's here. Thank each of you for being here. And who is going to lead off?
I'm here to testify in support of SB 525. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Ann Santa. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've spent the last 20 years in elementary schools as a school psychologist and 15 years as a private therapist with children. Sadly, I've had to work with many children and families to sort out and try to moderate the anxiety created by violence in our society. Much of this anxiety occurs because of impulsive behavior in the family setting. Suicide, domestic violence, accidental violent behavior. We cannot stop impulsive behavior, but we can moderate its consequences. How? Access to firearms in his singular moments of passion lead to permanent losses. The presence of a gun in domestic violence situation increases the risk of homicide for a woman by 500%. Near half of all domestic violence incidents are witnessed by children. These children will either withdraw, act out, and as adolescents, model after the aggressor. Oregon should codify the federal law into state statute and continue to prohibit the possession of firearm for a person who's been deemed by the court to be unsafe. Chaos in the home comes to school. The schools are struggling to provide students and parents and teachers a sense of safety while on the school grounds. This sense of safety has markedly diminished over the years. Firearms are the next great public health risks. The ability to bend the curve and reduce gun violence rests largely in the hands of the state legislature. Victims of domestic violence need and deserve all the help they can get. Law enforcement can moderate a crime of passion and sequelae of suicide or imprisonment of the perpetrator. This protects entire communities from the painful recovery from trauma. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. John?
Yeah. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is John Santa. I'm a primary care physician and a health administrator. You have my testimony. Yeah. It has a compelling case. You've certainly heard many others this morning. It has the statistics you've heard, which, as a physician and a public health person, if I saw those statistics for a disease and I saw the magnitude of the risk factors, there would be no question that the standard of care in the community would require that I do something about those. My own anecdote, my own past bad memory, is a wonderful woman who I took care of for a couple of years, multiple minor injuries. I was impressed that her husband was always there. He's very attentive, her child. And then one day I get a note from her that she will never be back. She's leaving the community. She's leaving her family. All of those injury visits were because of domestic violence. Her husband was there to make sure she didn't say anything. And, you know, the note, she thanked me. I mean, she basically thanked me, really, for failing. You know, I fell short. And I'm here in part because I think many health professionals would say, we need your help to not fall short of our professional obligations here. This is really tricky, complicated stuff. But this is a bad disease that we can do something about. Oregon's behind. I think the statistics support that. You can see those in my testimony and in what you've heard. I think in particular we're very concerned about the children that remain victims of this for the rest of their lives and the downstream impact that happened to those children and the folks that they interact with and their children. Thank you for allowing me to testify, to support Senate Bill 525. I think health professionals would broadly support this. I'm a member of the National Physicians Alliance, a national organization of thousands of physicians who realize we have to do more than just practice to meet our professional obligations. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for submitting your written testimony and then speaking from the heart. Who's next?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Chloe Massarello. I am the Research and Publications Coordinator at the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I assist in the coordination of the Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team. The coalition supports the passage of Senate Bill 525. A firearm is a tool that domestic violence perpetrators utilize to increase power and control over their victims. In the hands of domestic violence perpetrators, firearms are employed to intimidate, punish, threaten, and end the lives of their chosen victims, and sometimes themselves. Firearms are tools that escalate the severity and increase the ease of exercising power and control in abusive relationships. Murder is the ultimate act of power and control that an abuser can exercise. It represents the annihilation of the victim's autonomy. In Oregon, in any given year, approximately 60% of domestic violence deaths result from the use of a firearm. From 2003 through 2014, at least 220 people in our state were killed in this manner. My experience serving on the Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team, answering crisis calls and speaking with programs through my role at the Coalition, and researching this topic indicates that this final act is almost always preceded by a pattern of abuse that is severe enough to leave imprints in the local community. Someone, some organization, some hospital, some police agency knows that there is abuse. A restraining order is a red flag that cannot be ignored. Likewise, a conviction of a crime involving domestic violence is a red flag that cannot be ignored. Furthermore, abusers fear loss of control and escalate their abuse when victims take action. Prohibiting the abuser from possessing a firearm and ammunition following the granting of a restraining order or a conviction will protect victims and their children. It reduces ease of access to a tool that increases the risk of lethality. The Oregon Coalition represents 47 of the state's 56 domestic and sexual violence community organizations and works extensively with the rest. It is these organizations and their partners that work to keep victims safe and support surviving family members in the event of the worst outcome. On behalf of these programs and advocates, I urge you to increase the safety of domestic violence victims and their family members through passage of Senate Bill 525. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Jane?
Yes, it's Jane Downing.
Thank you.
Senator Perzanski, members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing. I'm the executive director of the Center for Hope and Safety, who is providing safety to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking for more than 40 years in Marion County. I'm here today to represent actually all the programs around the state of Oregon. You've heard amazing and compelling testimony. What I would like you to think about is that every day in programs in your communities, in your districts, there are individuals calling in saying, someone has held a gun to my head and said, I'm going to kill you. If you leave me, I'm going to kill you. If you take the children, I'm going to kill you. If you do whatever it is that I don't want you to do. This happens every single day in our communities. And this is one small way with Senate Bill 525 to address that type of intimidation, coercion, and fear tactics that are going on in our communities. We receive calls after domestic violence homicides, and I always cringe when there's a homicide. I cringe not only for the loss of that person, for their family, for their loved ones, for their community. I also cringe because I know the calls are going to come in on our 24-hour crisis line from women saying, he told me after this came out, the newspaper article, it was on the news, he told me that the next time that was going to be me or that was going to be our children. And think about that. Think about having to talk to those individuals and knowing that there are guns in their homes. And so I ask you all, please take this step to put us in line with the federal guidelines in order to protect officers, in order to protect women and children in their homes. Thank you very much for your consideration. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward today. Our next panel is going to be Kevin Sterrick and Dan Reed. And Rebecca Roth, why don't you go ahead and come up here? You're a late sign-on. And we'll go ahead and get you your testimony after theirs.
For the record, my name is Kevin Sterrett with the Oregon Firearms Federation. And before I start the actual testimony, I just heard a lot of stories today, and many of them, frankly, don't make too much sense to me. And the one I want to point out is the story that was told by Representative Peluso, who described this horrific crime scene she went to and then mentioned that the perpetrator was a longtime violent felon who, of course, already is prohibited from owning firearms. In its unamended form, Senate Bill 525 will be a dangerous expansion to a failed system. Currently in Oregon, judges have virtually unlimited discretion to seize firearms from persons who have restraining orders against them. These people can lose their rights with no accusation, let alone conviction of a crime. For some, like a Washington County Sheriff's deputy I spoke to a few years ago, this loss of rights can also mean a loss of employment. It's hard for me to square that with the idea of due process. As you know, if a person is the subject of a restraining order and the judge does not seize his firearms, he's still subject to a federal prohibition should he challenge the order and the order is upheld. For a person who's falsely accused but attempts to clear his name, this is almost certainly a no-win proposition. In many cases, the judge will ask the respondent if he plans on harassing the petitioner. Of course, he or she will say no. Then the judge will say, then you should have no trouble complying with this order. The order is upheld, and the person loses his or her firearms rights. This bill seeks to extend the authority to enforce a federal ban to local law enforcement. We believe that taking someone's rights away when they've not been convicted of a crime is wrong, no matter who is responsible for taking them. We don't believe a judge should have the discretion to take away someone's rights under those circumstances, but we certainly don't believe that if an Oregon judge has not taken away those rights, the federal government should be allowed to. But, of course, they currently are. To expand this does a disservice to Oregonians who may very well be guilty of nothing. But the bill goes further by expanding the list of qualifying offenses to, quote, any other misdemeanor that involves as an element of the crime the use of physical force or a deadly weapon. Oregon's definition of physical force is not particularly specific and is quite broad. Oregon's definition of who is a household member to which this bill would apply is also broad. It includes, quote, adults, persons related by blood or marriage. So if a person gets into a shoving match with an obnoxious brother-in-law under this bill, they'll be treated like a wife beater. We believe this demeans real acts of domestic violence. At very least, we believe this part of the bill needs to be removed. People who have committed acts of violence are subject to criminal prosecution. People who have been accused of no crime should not be subject to a loss of their rights. The Dash 3 amendments remove the expansion of what is mistakenly called domestic violence. The Dash 1 amendments return some measure of due process to people who are the subjects of restraining orders. I have read and heard the testimony of proponents of this bill, and one comment was, prohibiting the abuser from possessing a firearm and ammunition following the granting of a restraining order or conviction will protect victims and their children. It reduces ease of access to a tool that increases the risk of lethality. This is a fantasy and a very dangerous one. There are some things that are facts no matter how politically inconvenient they are. A truly dangerous person does not become less dangerous because some judge signed a piece of paper saying they could not own something. Until the people who claim to speak for victims face this and give victims tools to protect themselves instead of utterly meaningless papers from the court, innocent people will continue to die. I strongly urge you to stop pushing legislation that takes away rights from people who've done nothing wrong and instead consider legislation that empowers people who've been victimized.
Thank you. Dan?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Dan Reed with National Rifle Association. We're standing opposed to this bill as it expands on federal law. Kevin covered a lot of points, and really one of the main things I wanted to talk about was the expansion of who's eligible with it going to blood relations, et cetera. This vastly expands who can be convicted now of domestic violence, who becomes a prohibited possessor. And so that's where our opposition comes from. Also, how this could apply retroactively to someone who maybe has been convicted. Now it's currently not considered misdemeanor domestic violence, which would be a prohibitor, and now all of a sudden they become a criminal overnight. So in the interest of brevity, that's where we are. We oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Rebecca?
Okay. I want to address, the paper I'm going to submit addresses.
I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, Rebecca Roth, South Salem.
Okay.
Thank you. And my paper addresses a plan that was put into place by Margaret Sanger, who still influences our society today. She called it the Negro Project, and that plan has influenced both feminists and people who are in the feminist movement, and also people who have been members of the KKK, et cetera. The plan was to have people self-destroy. So I really encourage you guys to read this. I want to get to what I actually want to say, but I want to encourage you to read this.
What points do you have on Senate Bill 525?
What I want to say about the bill is that it causes the government to take away the rights of people who
have not yet committed a crime, like he was saying. My concern is that in our schools, we're training up young men who do not learn self-discipline. They learn licentiousness, and licentiousness does not train them in their character to view others, to not have locker room behavior. And I also believe that the idea of having boys and girls go to school together teaches young men to view women as their locker room partners, which means that they treat them the way they would other young men. And the complexity of the way people treat each other is vastly improved if we use the constraints that God has given to us in our. He's the one that made us. He knows how we function. And I want to draw your attention to the fact that Ted Cruz this week talked about how his dad was so violent and how he abandoned his mother.
Ms. Roth,
he was changed in his character by accepting the Lord Jesus Christ.
Roth.
And we need to encourage our young people
I need you to get back on focus on Senate Bill 525 points regarding the bill. If you don't have any other things about 525.
I see character development as being the clue to this. Character development teaches young men to treat women correctly. We need to stop having young men look at women as being their locker room people that they can treat that way.
All right. Thank you very much.
And I encourage you to read about the Negro Project.
Thank you very much. Does anyone on the panel have questions for any of the individuals? I'm sorry. Yeah, Senator Burdick.
Just for the NRA representative, that Huffington Post says that the NRA accepted bills that were very similar to this in Washington State, Wisconsin, Louisiana, and Minnesota, specifically affecting restraining orders. What is different about Oregon that would make you oppose it here?
Mr. Chairman, through you, for the record, Dan Reed, to Senator Burdick. I will go back and review those bills. It's very tough for me. I cover several states, but not all of them, and so I will gladly look into those and get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair, follow up. You do cover Washington, is that correct?
I do not.
Okay. Dan, what states do you cover?
I cover Hawaii, Oregon, Nevada, and Arizona.
Not California?
Not California.
Okay. All right. That's great. Any other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm closing the public hearing on 525. We've already opened up a hearing on 526, and what I'm going to do is we have a number of people who want to speak on multiple bills that are left. So, Jeff, why don't you first give us an overview of 526?
Certainly, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 526 modifies and expands the definition of physical injury in the criminal code. It provides that a person commits felony-level strangulation if the person commits the strangulation knowing that the victim is pregnant. The bill states that in the case of a crime where an element of the offense is that the crime is committed in the immediate presence of a minor child, the minor child qualifies as a victim under statute. Lastly, the bill directs the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to classify a violation of a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order as a Class A misdemeanor.
I'd like for you to go ahead. I'm going to open now also public hearings on 563 and Senate Bill 3, if you give us the overviews on those.
Certainly, Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Senate Bill 563 mandates that law enforcement agencies submit a report to the Attorney General by September 15, 2015, stating the number of untested sexual assault evidence kits in the possession of the law enforcement agency and the date the evidence was collected. It requires the Attorney General to submit a report to the interim legislative committees related to judiciary, summarizing the number of statewide untested evidence kits. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There are proposed dash ones in front of us today that state that a law enforcement agency must submit an annual report no later than February 1 of each year. It provides that prior to destroying untested evidence collection kits, the law enforcement agency shall notify the victim at least 60 days prior to destruction and allow the victim to take possession of the kit in lieu of destruction. And then lastly, Senate Bill 3, this bill classifies the crime or creates the crime of endangering a person protected by a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order and classifies the offense as a Class C felony. We have proposed amendments, dash four amendments, which create a Class A misdemeanor offense if the defendant previously violated a FAPA order against the same victim, and defines previous conviction for the purposes of the section.
All right. Senator.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lori Monis Anderson, State Senator from Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and parts of East Portland. I call this the Enhancement Domestic Violence Statute, and Senator Winters was so sorry that she could not stay, but wanted to let her know she is a chief sponsor of this bill, and wanted to make sure I conveyed the fact that people, victims of domestic violence are become a part of the rest of the system, and we really need to do things that will try to prevent domestic violence in this state. I just want to go through Senate Bill 526 does four things. Section 1 and 2 expands the definition of physical injury trauma in criminal code. And basically what I did is I took this straight from the animal abuse statutes. I think there are problems with it. I would love to work with the advocates on maybe cleaning up that definition of maybe, and I need direction. I'm a nurse. I know what domestic violence looks like because I've worked with these victims as a public health nurse. So that's section 1 and 2. Section 3 actually increases the penalty for crime of strangulation when the defendant knows the victim is pregnant. That is pretty much makes the statute consistent with the assault statute. Pretty straightforward. Section 1 and 2 have a minimal fiscal impact. Section 2 has minimal, Section 3 has minimal fiscal impact. But then we get to Section 4, and Section 4 actually expands the criminal counts that can be added to a crime for each child witness to a crime. This is where it may have a substantial fiscal, because each child witnessing would be able to become a victim and then therefore be given services that are available for the children, Kids First, Northwest Cares, et cetera. I realize that, but I felt it was important. And then Section 4, I would actually like to take out. This is in Senate Bill 3. And if, as long as you go with the dash 4 amendments, then I would remove Section 4 from this bill if Section 3 is going forward with the dash 4 amendments. I wanted to be very, very brief. There is a minor fiscal impact on Section 3, and there is a slightly larger impact on Section 4. So I just want to be brief because I know you want to get through. Then Section Senate Bill 563, these are untested rape kits. Nationwide, there's a backload of unanalyzed sexual assault forensics evidence kits. And thousands of rape kits have been discovered in police evidence rooms, never sent to a crime lab for analysis. And that's why I brought Senate Bill 563 before you. Oregon really needs to ensure that all rape victims from whom a rape kit is collected will have a chance for justice, and to be sure that serial criminals are taken off the streets. I have talked with the Oregon State Police and the police chiefs, and we have decided that it's really important first to do an inventory in the state of all backlogged rape kits, because there may be reasons why we have unanalyzed rape kits. So hopefully then the Oregon State Police and police chiefs will bring back to the Judiciary Committee no later than September 15, 2015, which we had talked about, and they would provide reasons why so many rape kits have not been analyzed. So this bill may not be prime time this session. After the report, then maybe it might be prime time for the 2016 session. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Cruz?
Yeah. You can't leave yet. Because we're sponsors of that bill, so and I have Mr. Chair talk to them as well, and especially I know the president's got a bill to expand the statute of limitations on rape, which I support as well. So I do think we need to get a firmer grip on the universe we're dealing with here, not only what exists, but the capacity the system has if we go to, let's say, I think the president wanted to go to 20 years, which is a long time. So how you deal with evidence over that period of time. So I think, Senator Monsanto, you're right. We need to put together a little work group and make this ready for prime time in the short session.
All right. Thank you very much. So the first panel is we, Dinah, if you'll come on up. Aaron, if you were already up, please come on back up. And then I got Kevin Barton and Melissa Allison. I'm going 3 minutes. Oh, and Dinah, you're signed up on all three.
Yes, I am.
So if you could give us, you know, through succinctly your testimony on all three, that way we won't run you back and forth three times.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vitalens. I'm here as both the Crook County District Attorney and a representative of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. In terms of Senate Bill 526, the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports sections 1-4. And as Senator Manas Anderson said, we believe that section 5 is addressed in Senate Bill 3-4 amendments. Essentially, the other witnesses will talk about basically why we'd like to expand the definition of physical injury is to really address two Court of Appeals cases where the Court of Appeals held that significant bruising on a child and then pulling a victim's hair out in a domestic violence incident was not physical injury for purposes of Oregon law. And so other witnesses will talk about that, but I think it's important to remember that expanding this definition will help us to hold offenders accountable who recklessly, knowingly, or intentionally hurt others. In terms of Section 2, essentially making the crime of strangulation a Class C felony where the victim is pregnant is already the law in the Assault 4 statute, and so it would just mirror each other, which is important. Section 4 allows prosecutors to consider each child victim who witnesses an incident of domestic violence to file separate charges, and I believe that will be a significant impact in terms of fiscal, if you've got consecutive counts in terms of each assault that occurs. But we do support that. And then in terms of Section 5, the contempt of court, we prefer, as Crook County District Attorney, I prefer Senate Bill 3, Section 4 amendments. Worked with Senator Courtney's office on that. And so then to turn to Senate Bill 563, essentially there are many, many, again, members of the committee. My name is Dinah Vitalens, and I'm here as Crook County District Attorney and on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. There are many reasons why we do not test evidence collection kits. For instance, in Crook County, our sexual assault protocols require that or offer evidence collection kit or a SANE exam to every victim, whether that victim's going to report the crime or wishes us to prosecute or not. And so if that victim's not going to go forward with criminal charges at that point, that kit will be held in evidence. In terms of other evidence collection kits, there might be consensual sexual contact in terms of a defendant may say there's consensual contact and the victim is saying something different. We will collect that evidence kit, and we may not test it because there might not be any need to do that because the defendant has admitted to the contact. However, we'll keep that, and we'll keep that throughout the proceeding just in case we need that. So there are many reasons why the kits may not be tested. And also in that sort of a case, if the case is on appeal, then it may be years before we're actually able to destroy it or otherwise not go forward with it. So what we would prefer is a work group with the chief sheriffs, Oregon State Police, and the district attorney's office. We think it's important to provide a report to you that tells you why, how many kits are untested, and why that is not going to happen, and what are the resources that we need, and what's the process we should do in order to get any kits that need to be tested.
Let me just make for the record on 563, we've already had a number of offline discussions. We will be having a work group. We will be moving that forward. That's how we're going to do it. So 563 itself is not moving this session as it's currently written, for we can get this other information.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Dinah Vitalins. I'm here as Crook County District Attorney in support of Senate Bill 3 with the Dash 4 amendments.
I should have told you don't need to re-identify yourself each time.
I apologize.
Too late now.
Well, I would say that Kevin Campbell is my instructor in terms of testimony, and he has.
He owes you.
Could you? Yeah.
He owes you.
Okay. In terms of.
He's coming up here. Don't worry. We'll take care of
that. Sorry, Kevin. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 3 with the Dash 4 amendments. After the original public hearing, I met with Senator Courtney's office and other individuals about the original legislation. And Senate, the Dash 4 amendments essentially keep the process that I talked about previously, where district attorneys have a rocket docket, essentially, where they're able to quickly and effectively hold individuals who violate restraining orders accountable and do so quickly without the jury trial and much more quickly than other counties. So it preserves that because the first violation of the restraining order is a contempt. If the individual is found to be in violation of the restraining order and then subsequently violates the same restraining order against the same victim, it then becomes a Class A misdemeanor, and then the third violation is a Class C felony. And we think that that graduated increasingly more serious consequences is a good approach to keep as many tools for prosecutors open. The other part of the bill, which was very important to Senator Courtney, was that if essentially an offender menaces or recklessly endangers the victim while violating the restraining order, that should be a Class C felony from the get-go. And so those were the two kind of compromises that we came up with so that we could go forward with Senate Bill 3. Thank you.
Thank you. Erin?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenewald. I'm an attorney for the Department of Justice Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 526, and thanks to Senator Montes Anderson and others for sponsoring that, as well as 525. As you've heard Ms. Fiddleman say, there is support for and need for the change to the physical injury definition, and Senator Montes Anderson referenced that she got this definition from the animal abuse statute. I just wanted to give you a little more background on that, because I think sometimes when things have been law for a certain period of time, we forget why things were necessary. So that change came about in 2001 after an incident was observed at the Portland Zoo to the elephant Rose 2, who was being physically abused by a zookeeper. The definitions that prosecutors used to have to use for animal abuse were almost identical to what we are currently using for human abuse. And as you can imagine, that's difficult to get an animal to articulate that the animal is feeling pain, substantial pain, because they can't do that. And so they came up with a different way to, under a reasonable person's standard or an objective standard, to determine whether an animal had suffered an injury. The same is true, the same difficulties are true, and I know that Mr. Barton is going to address this. The same are true when you deal with children who are nonverbal, or you're dealing with domestic violence victims who, for a lot of reasons, cannot participate or do not want to participate and do not want to articulate their pain or their injury. So we support the change, understanding that there might be some wordsmithing that needs to happen with that section. I also support Section 3, the strangulation when the victim is pregnant. As you well know, until January 1 of 2012, commission of a strangulation was always a misdemeanor. Until then, Representative Gelser sponsored House Bill 2940, increasing under certain circumstances a misdemeanor strangulation to a felony. What we didn't include, I think at the last minute wasn't included, was this provision that would be consistent with assault. So as Ms. Vitalin said, it's really just a housekeeping measure that is clearly necessary when a victim is pregnant, that if the offender knows that, then it should be elevated to a felony. Section 4, when this was passed some years ago,
meaning that under certain circumstances, an assault can be elevated to a felony. One of those circumstances is when a child witnesses or is in the immediate presence of the assault, that it becomes a felony. We did so because we understood the harm to the children. Now there is case law that makes us feel like we can charge separate crimes for each child who witnesses that incident, because of course there is separate harm to each of those children, and so I would urge you to support that section. And finally, not only as the Department of Justice's domestic violence resource prosecutor, but also as the co-chair of the fatality review team, and I hope that each of you saw the report that was sent to you, the recommendations by the fatality review team are to make restraining orders a crime, whether it's under Senate Bill 3 or some other provision. So thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Kevin?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Kevin Barton. I'm a senior deputy DA in the Washington County DA's office. I'm also the chair of our county child abuse multidisciplinary team, which consists of members from the community DHS, educators, medical professionals, law enforcement, and prosecutors, among others. I'm also the chair of our county child fatality review team, and I'm here regarding Senate Bill 526. Specifically, I'd like to speak with you about the change, or the proposed change, to the definition of a physical injury. And this change is necessary not because there's been a change in the way children are abused, or not because there's been a change in our statutes, because physical injury has been defined the same way ever since 1971, when our criminal code first came into being. But instead, it's necessary because of a recent change in the interpretation of our statutes from the Court of Appeals. And specifically, I'm referring to a case that came out in 2012 called State versus Wright, which involved a 16-month-old baby, a toddler, who was struck by a babysitter, an adult babysitter, several times and severely bruised. And the Court of Appeals held in that case that that child did not suffer a physical injury, even though the trial judge and the jury had concluded, in fact, that there was enough evidence of a physical injury. And what I'd like to do is, we've in the field, those of us that deal with these cases, have known about State versus Wright and that holding since 2012. But it was only a few months ago when I first saw the pictures. And I can't tell you this story, and I can't explain to you the need for this change without showing you the pictures. And so I have a copy of the exact photos that were used in that case that the trial court exhibits, and I'd like to submit them to this body so that you can review those as well and understand the need for this.
All right,
so,
Kevin, my understanding prior to starting the hearing, there was going to be an opportunity for members to look at those offline.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Chair. Dr. Leonhardt, who's also testifying and has photos, has some photos which are offline.
Okay.
But these photos I'd like to make part of the public record.
Okay, that's fine.
So may I? And I'd urge you to take a look at those photos as you're considering this issue. No one can look at those photos and not instantly think this child was injured, or this child must have had substantial pain or an impairment of a physical condition, because that's what the current state of the law defines a physical injury to be. But those photos have now become the benchmark by which we are forced to judge what cases we can and cannot proceed on. And it's had a significant and detrimental impact on our ability to protect children. And specifically, it's detrimentally impacted nonverbal children, so babies and toddlers who can't speak. It's impacted children who are not competent as witnesses, but who nonetheless can speak, but they can't come into court to testify because they're not old enough. Typically under the age of five, they can't be competent as witnesses. It's impacted children who are older of all ages, but who are developmentally delayed, who are unable to articulate themselves. And it's impacted children who have been chronic victims of abuse. And I've seen this in my practice, and I know my colleagues around the state have as well. Some recent examples of cases where we've been unable to file charges. For example, we had a 14-year-old child who came in with welts and bruises on her forearm and on her thigh. The suspect had admitted to hitting her with a cord, which is a common disciplinary tool. She said it didn't hurt. Her quote was, "I really don't feel pain. I'm used to getting hit." We can't prosecute that case now because of State versus Wright.
Kevin, I hate to do this to you.
I understand. Let me just summarize by saying I'm happy to answer any questions anyone has afterwards. I know you're short on time. Thank you for considering the bill.
Good. Thank you very much. And Melissa.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Melissa Allison, Deputy District Attorney for Marion County. I've been prosecuting domestic crimes for the last 7 years, domestic violence crimes for the last 7 years, excuse me, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 526. Specifically, I'd like to speak to strangulation of pregnant victims and also child witnesses of domestic abuse. As Ms. Greenwald referenced, strangulation has been considered a felony in certain circumstances over the last year. Other than that, it was only a misdemeanor. So that means that no matter the circumstances of the strangulation, an offender may only be sentenced to up to 1 year in local jail. However, in reality, it has been much less than that. I've prosecuted dozens, if not over 100, misdemeanor strangulation crimes. And the offender may get a month or two in jail, but more likely will be released to bench probation. This means that there will be a no-contact order, usually, with the victim, in order to do domestic violence treatment and check in with a court in a few months. There's no probation officer. There's no real supervision. Generally, only felony probationers get supervised probation with a probation officer. This is alarming because victims of strangulation are at 7 times greater risk of being killed by their perpetrator than other types of domestic violence victims. Strangulation is very closely linked to lethality because of the unseen and yet serious internal injuries that occur when one is strangled. This is made much more lethal with repeated occurrences, and coupled with the intensity of strangulation perpetrators is a deadly combination. Why would a victim risk reporting strangulation when their perpetrator would likely be released pretty much immediately? Last year, the legislature, as Ms. Greenwald mentioned, did make strangulation a felony under certain circumstances. However, strangulation was not increased to be a felony when committed against a pregnant victim. A pregnant victim is at an increased risk of violence for several reasons. First of all, research shows that a domestic violence perpetrator's need for power and control is increased when their victim is pregnant. Also, a pregnant victim is more physically vulnerable to violence and danger. She's less able to defend herself. In strangulation cases, she is at greater risk of developing blood clots and stroke. As a result of strangulation, she is at risk of other pregnancy complications, which also endanger her health. We see examples of this regularly. In one recent case that I had, a victim who was over 7 months pregnant, less than 1.5 months away from giving birth, was abused by her boyfriend, the father, and he was upset because she took $7 of his and set it aside for a bus fare the next day so that she could go to the doctor. Among other things, he grabbed her by the throat.
I need you to wrap up, please.
Okay. He pushed her up against the wall, making it impossible for her to breathe. She started seeing gray. She thought that he was going to kill her. He didn't in that case. But all in all, the only consequence for that act would be a misdemeanor, not a felony. So all in all, I'm just asking that the legislature, that we all here recognize that strangling a pregnant victim should be a felony. Also, that child witnesses to assault should be recognized as individual victims. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel, John Trusco, I believe. I may have said that wrong. Dr. Dan Leonhart and Gil Meyer. Okay. Who'd ever like to get started, please?
Chair Przanski and members
of the Senate. If you can move the mic over, there you go. Thank you.
Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is John Troncoso. I'm a lieutenant with the Kaiser Police Department. I've been there for 25 years, 24 of which has been in the Criminal Investigations Division. And some of our main duties are investigation of child abuse and also homicide investigation. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police to urge your support of Senate Bill 526, and I'm also here to speak to Senate Bill 3 as well. I'll start with 526. I've submitted my testimony in writing, so I won't read through that for you. I did want to talk about two aspects of that, though, to add to those. Number one is the part of the 526 where it speaks to adding to the definition of victim the minor children for the crimes that they are witnessing. I think that this is very important. I'm not an expert on the psychology, but since my training in the academy more than two decades ago, I remember them talking about the cycle of abuse. And at the time, I didn't understand it. It didn't make much sense to me why somebody would grow up to repeat something that they didn't like from the start. But I would have to say that throughout the course of my career, I've investigated numerous cases of abuse, and both speaking with victims and then obviously interviewing suspects. And one of the things that I do have to say is my experience has borne out the things I was trained about, which is that people do repeat the cycle of abuse. And so I think this is important because I think Senate Bill 526 takes an important step because it recognizes the damage that is being done to children who witness crimes, particularly domestic violence. The second thing I wanted to speak to with regard to 526 is I'm very happy to see the definition of physical trauma make its way into physical injury. And the reason I say that is we have been interviewing people, investigating cases for quite some time, and many times we are trying to determine if there was substantial pain or impairment of physical condition. I'm pleased to see that this actually spells out what those are. We can see bruises, we can see scrapes, we can photograph those, we can document those, and many times people don't want to describe those to us because they've been threatened not to talk to us. Sometimes the children are too young to talk, and so in this, for me, from an investigative standpoint, this is huge because it takes the definition of physical injury out of the subjective, what did they say it felt like, what did they say it's causing them, and it puts it into the objective, what can we see? Bruises, cuts, scrapes, fractures.
Okay.
I also wanted to speak to Senate Bill 3. And again, you have my testimony in writing, so I won't read through that. And I think that DA Vitalins did a good job of speaking to the needs for this bill. I just wanted to mention that domestic violence and restraining order violation incidents represent one of the most dangerous things that we respond to, and certainly one of the most dangerous things that many victims are exposed to. And I won't get into the details of too many cases, but we have a case from just 2 months ago this year where we have somebody who's violated these no-contact orders that they have, and we need more tools to be able to work within this to ensure victim safety. Silverton, Oregon, from last summer, has a horrific case that obviously resulted in the death of the very same thing. Two of my investigators worked on that case, so I had the opportunity to see exactly what went on in reviewing the reports. There is a clear need for this, and this would strengthen our ability to protect victims.
Thank you very much. Testimony. Appreciate it.
Doctor?
Sure. Hi, my name is Dr. Dan Leinhart. I'm a pediatrician, child abuse pediatrician, and the medical director of CARES Northwest, a child abuse clinic in Portland. Thank you, Chair Prozanski, and members of the committee for letting me be here today. As a child abuse pediatrician, I wanted to address two important reasons to support Senate Bill 526. First, among the types of child maltreatment, child physical abuse is among the most deadly. Among the hundreds of children that are seen each year in centers like CARES Northwest and in our children's hospitals, bruising is the most common finding and sometimes the only finding. There's sometimes a misconception that the presence of bruising alone indicates that the child was not subject to serious physical violence. And occasionally I will hear, it's only bruising. The reality is that many of our bruised only children have been subjected to extreme violence. I have some photos to share with committee members if they want of cases, select cases demonstrating that. In one example, Jacob, a 2-year-old, admitted to the hospital with bruising to his legs, arms, back, buttocks, and face. He had over 50 bruises to his body, yet he did not show any broken bones or internal injuries. The following day, he was roaming the halls of the hospital demonstrating the resiliency of a young child. An investigation revealed that he had been punched, slapped, kicked, and thrown to the floor multiple times. Nobody who saw Jacob during those days would have said he just has bruising. Second, recognizing bruising as a potentially serious form of child abuse allows us to act with proportionate response in helping protect children against further life-threatening injury. In a recent study from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, it was discovered that approximately 30% of the infants and toddlers who suffered abusive head trauma had been seen previously with bruising. One conclusion drawn from this study was that these young children who initially presented with bruising were subject to repeated and escalated violence. I would like to thank the opportunity to thank the sponsors of Senate Bill 526 for standing up and speaking for our youngest and, by definition, our most vulnerable children. Thank you.
Doctor, thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Chair, in observation of the time, I'd like to inquire, would it be possible for me to give my testimony sometime, even tomorrow? It's been a long day, and it's hard to get it into 1 minute.
You're going to be talking on 526?
526 exclusively, sections 1 and 2 and sections 4.
That's possible. I'm not sure what our schedule is. I may roll it over with that intent for taking your testimony only because we've got everyone else covered, and I got 563 still to do.
Okay, so you want me to proceed? Is that what you're saying?
No.
No.
I don't.
Okay.
We'll capture it. We'll roll it over for that purpose.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so let me just give a game plan here. We're just after 10 o'clock. I've got one more panel to bring up for 563, which I'm going to let them testify. I know, members, you have probably other obligations. If you need to leave, feel free to do so. But at this point, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3. Close the public hearing, I think, if I haven't already, on 525. And we're going to roll over the testimony of the public hearing for the remainder of the testimony, which is for Gail Meyer on 526 for tomorrow.
Do we want to roll over the work session on SB3?
And we're going to roll over for the work session on SB3 as well for tomorrow. So we're going to continue that as a rollover for the work session. And then we're going to continue with the testimony we have on 563. So, gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm sorry for the rush. I appreciate you being here, though. So the last panel I have is Kevin Campbell, Pat Ashmore, Jackie Swanson, and Brenda Tracy. My understanding is everyone's coming forward is that there's already been an understanding that this is going into a work group, and so I think there's a few things that just need to be put on the record. And the ladies, I know y'all want to put some stuff on the record as to the purpose and why the need for the work group. And Pat, I'm sorry to keep you for as long as I have, but if you'd like to come up and make some statements on behalf of this state police, please do so.
Chair, do you want me to just go quickly?
Yes.
Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. As you've already mentioned, there's a work group in the works, and I just wanted to commit on behalf of the Chiefs Association to work with Oregon State Police, Oregon State Sheriff's Association, to deliver to this committee inventory of untested sexual assault kits and their disposition, so you'll understand as a committee why they are currently untested and to look at options for how we might address that fact. I would respond just briefly to a dash one amendment we're not considering because of the work group, but there was an opportunity in that amendment for a victim to regain possession of a untested kit. I would just say that at that point the kit would lose its evidentiary value because of a break in the chain of custody. It would no longer be valuable if somebody decided to take a case forward in the future. And I would just also say that agencies must retain these untested kits and evidence for the period of the reasonable statute of limitations. They should not be destroyed in advance of that. And our agencies work very closely with our district attorney's offices, and they do not destroy evidence before they are directed or approved to do so. Based on that conversation, I've heard some conversation about some specific incidences. If that was done, that would be incorrect. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Pat?
Senator Prozanski, members of the committee, I just want to echo Mr. Campbell's sentiments. We are committed to work with our law enforcement agency partners We understand the national campaign and the sensitivity of this, so we are very much committed to press on. We have a lot of work to do, but we'll get it done.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there any questions for either of the gentlemen? Y'all are free to step back if you'd like. Ladies, I apologize for the shortness in time, but we do want to take your testimony since you're here.
Sure. Greetings, Senator Brzezinski, chair members. My name is Jacqueline Swanson. I'm an attorney with O'Donnell Clark and Crew, and I'm
pretty great.
And I'm here today on behalf to support SB 563, although with the understanding now that it's going to be moved forward towards a work group, I feel that perhaps my testimony, to the extent that I could give it today, would be more valuable if I could answer questions that you might have. I will state at the outset that I've conducted a lot of research, extensive research into this subject, addressing all of the issues that were raised here with respect to 563 today in terms of the reasons for testing and untesting, the reasons why some RAID kits remain untested, and the reasons why some kits should be tested, even in spite of those reasons, as well as evidence retention laws in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, how that interacts with these RAID kit evidentiary procedures, victims' rights and victim notification in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, and the ease of integrating existing and potential systems that we already have in place in order to effect the change that we desperately need. So I would offer, to the extent that the work group comes.
I think you've just volunteered for the work group. How's that?
In a sense, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes. And if I can help in any way, I would like to.
But we'll definitely make certain that you have an invitation to be part of that work group.
That would be wonderful. I would appreciate that.
That's my pleasure.
And I want to let Brenda
go. Yeah, I was going to ask Brenda if she'd like to say something.
Hi. Well, my name is Brenda Tracy, and I am the survivor of a gang rape, and I am a victim of our legal system, unfortunately. I'm supporting 563 because in my case, I was brutally gang raped by four men, and I did what I was supposed to do. I reported to the police. I did my rape kit after. The police did their part. They collected all the evidence, and my rape lasted over about 7 hours, and there was a alcohol bottle used, a flashlight used. It was a pretty horrific incident for me, and I was even suicidal after. But all of that evidence was collected. The rape kit was done. Everything was there. And unfortunately, I was told by the district attorney that I had a he said, she said case. I was not informed that they could move forward without my testimony. So I pressed charges. I did my rape kit. I pressed charges. The men were arrested and put into jail overnight. Over the next 2 weeks, I felt the backlash from the media. Personal friends and family turned against me, blamed me. I was embarrassed. I was humiliated. I was degraded in the media, in my personal life. I was told by the district attorney I'd have to go through 4 separate trials, and that it was my word against their word. And after receiving 2 death threats against myself and my small children, I decided not to move forward with prosecution. Recently in the Oregonian, John Canzano went back and talked to all of these people, and it looks as though everything was there for a solid case for my rapist to go to prison, and I was not informed of this. All of my evidence was destroyed after 2 years. It was not kept for the statute of limitations. So even if I had gone back 4 or 5 years later, everything was gone, and it would have been a he said, she said case at that point. I'm proposing in 563 that not only do we keep the evidence for the statute of limitations, which people say we do, but there are cases where it does not happen. People do destroy the evidence, depending on what the situation is, and I'm asking that victims be notified before the evidence is destroyed. I think back now and I wonder, what if somebody had called me and said, we're going to destroy the evidence? What if at that point I had known that I had a case? my life is important. Other rape victims' lives are important. There's a statute of limitations for a reason, but my statute of limitations was 2 years. Because unfortunately, as a victim, we think we have rights, but really my rights were dependent on the people in power and what they decided my statute of limitations were and what they decided my rights were, and that's not okay. So I just ask that you support this bill, 563, to allow victims to have some kind of control, some kind of involvement in the process to just save someone like me. If there is something going on that should not be happening, I just don't want there to be another me. I don't, and that's why I'm here today. So thanks.
Brenda, thank you very much. I know this is very difficult for you to be coming forward, and I know you've had an opportunity to meet with some of the members individually. You show a lot of courage in an individual bringing forward an unjust, and we heard your testimony. We'll take it into consideration, and I, as the chair, and I can speak, I think, for everyone on the dais and for the committee, we thank you for stepping forward. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah, can I be part of the work group?
Well, we're going to kind of get the work group set up, and we'll see how we're going to have the different people in there, but we'll make certain that you know of the work group.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, with that, we're going to, before we adjourn, I just want to go on the record once again to make certain we've done everything right for the crossing the T's and dotting the I's. Based on the work we did today, we're carrying over the work session on Senate Bill 3 for tomorrow. That will be Thursday, the 26th, and we are also carrying over the public hearing on 526 for the exclusive purpose of taking the testimony we did not get today, which is of Gail Myers. With that, I think that concludes our work. Thank you all very much for staying. We're adjourned. Thank you all very much for staying.